Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. It is time to listen and learn, as we tell you about interesting events in our world in a way that makes it easy for you to understand. We will begin with something new from former U.S. President Bush. Which one? In this case, it is a father speaking about his son. Ann Ball takes the story from there.
For all 8 years of his son's presidency, former President George Herbert Walker Bush was supportive. But in a new book about his life and politics, President George Herbert Walker Bush mildly criticizes his son, George Walker Bush. The elder Bush says he approves of some of his son's controversial decisions, such as invading Iraq. But sometimes his son used overly hot rhetoric, the senior Bush says. George H.W. Bush mentioned a 2002 speech describing an axis of evil. In the speech, George W. Bush said Iran, North Korea, and Iraq were among the nations that fit the axis of evil description. Tough talk will get you headlines, but it doesn't necessarily solve the diplomatic problem, George H.W. Bush said. His comments came in John Meacham's new book, Destiny and Power. George H.W. Bush served as president from 1989 to 1993. George W. Bush was the U.S. president from 2001 to 2009. George H.W. Bush was the 41st president of the United States. His son, George W. Bush, was number 43. In the interviews with Meacham, George H.W. Bush says his son was not well served by two of his administration's top officials, Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Both had iron-ass views, the senior Bush said. By that, Bush meant he believed the two officials were acting too tough in dealing with threats to the United States after the 2001 terrorist attacks. Cheney and Rumsfeld served as President George W. Bush's key advisors. They promoted U.S. military action overseas after the 9/11 terrorist attacks on New York City and Washington. They pushed for U.S. war efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq. Cheney had his own empire there and marched to his own drummer, Bush said. Rumsfeld was an arrogant fellow, he said. The younger Bush said in a statement that he was proud to have served with Cheney and Rumsfeld. He said both did a good job for him and the American people. Over the weekend, George W. Bush talked about the book with its author, John Meacham. The discussion was broadcast from his presidential library in Texas. Bush expressed surprise at some of the book's disclosures. He said he hadn't seen the diaries his dad had kept, the ones Meacham used to write the book. But George W. Bush said proudly that his dad strongly supported his most controversial decision, the one to go to war with Iraq in 2003. At Meacham's urging, the younger Bush read aloud a letter from his father. The elder Bush wrote about how proud he was of his son's leadership in dealing with Iraq. Another George H.W. Bush son, Jeb, is running for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. I'm Ann Ball.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Most people are born with two sets of teeth. We use baby teeth to break down food as children. As we become adults, the baby teeth are replaced with permanent or adult teeth. By age 65, 30% of all people worldwide have lost all their teeth. But did you know that most bony fish can regrow their lost teeth? A team of scientists is wondering if that ability of some fish could somehow lead to human tooth regeneration, with adult men and women producing additional teeth as needed. Marcia James tells us more.
Fish do it all the time. Whenever they lose a tooth, a new one drops into place. Cichlids are a popular tropical fish. They keep their teeth throughout adulthood. If a tooth should fall out, another one takes its place. Todd Strillman teaches biology at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. He is working with cichlids to find out which genes help the fish keep their teeth.
Our approach is to find things that are hard to study otherwise and then target them in these animals. So in this case, Lake Malawi cichlid fishes and many other fishes regenerate their dentition throughout their entire life.
As a result, a mouthful of teeth is replaced every 50 days. Professor Strillman and his team reported on their study of cichlids in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They looked at embryonic cell tissue that can develop into either teeth or taste buds.
And what we found was some really interesting commonalities between teeth and taste buds in their earliest development.
Unlike humans, fish have no tongues in the mouth, so their taste buds are mixed in with their teeth. Last year, the same researchers made a cichlid genome, a map of the fish genes. This year, they crossed closely related cichlids and then compared genetic differences among the second generation fish. They found what appeared to be genetic controls that could make the embryonic cells become either a tooth or taste bud.
We could identify this because the genes that are typically positive markers of taste buds and the genes that are typically positive markers of teeth were co-expressed. They were expressed in the same places. So we basically could watch the path through development where this epithelium at one point was bipotent and then became either teeth or taste buds.
Teeth and taste buds begin in the same kind of tissue around the mouth of fish in their earliest stages of development. The researchers made and studied mapped cichlid genomes. They then engineered the undifferentiated tissue in fish to increase production of teeth but cut back on taste buds. This was done at an early stage when the fish had eyes and a brain but were still growing jaws. It turns out that cichlids are not the only animals that express these genes. Todd Strillman says researchers at King's College London demonstrated that a few poorly studied genes in mice were also involved in the development of teeth and taste buds.
These genes that we had identified in fishes are, in fact, also active in the earliest development of teeth on the jaw margin and taste buds on the tongue of mice.
Professor Strillman says the studies in fish and mice suggest that with the right signals, the tissue in humans might also be able to develop new teeth. The direction our research is taking, at least in human health, he says, is to figure out how to coax, work on the tissue to form one type of structure or the other. I'm Marcia James.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the Environment and Science Report. Jerry Schubel is president and CEO of the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach, California.
More than half of the world's population lives in water-stressed areas, and according to the United Nations, that number will increase to two-thirds by 2025, less than 10 years from now.
Jerry Schubel says the amount of water on Earth has not changed for billions of years, but the ratio of fresh to salt water has. He also says there are also other factors that are creating a freshwater shortage.
In much of the world, shortage of fresh water is a looming crisis that will only be exacerbated by climate change and a growing population.
Schubel says most of the world's population live in countries that share bodies of water. Many of those countries don't have agreements on how to share that water. Schubel says the problem of global water shortage can be solved only if countries work together.
We could supply everyone on this planet with safe drinking water and enough water to grow their food. But it will take money, technology, political will, and cooperation. And learning how to share requires collaborative decision-making at intergovernmental levels.
Water shortages plague many parts of the world. Heat waves could become the norm in the Persian Gulf by the end of the century. Just this past summer, very hot high temperatures in Iran sent the heat index, a combination of temperature and humidity, up to 73 degrees Celsius. The reason? Climate change. According to new research, the combination of intense sun and shallow waters makes the Persian Gulf area a specific regional hotspot where climate change is a threat to human health. Heat could be so intense that in many regional cities, the temperature could exceed a tipping point for human survival, even in shaded and well-ventilated spaces. A team of scientists from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Loyola Marymount University published their writing in the journal Nature of Climate Change. The study also found at high levels of heat and humidity, even a healthy young adult is at risk. When temperatures soar, humans cool off by sweating. The evaporating sweat carries heat away. But when it's very humid, evaporation slowed, and it's harder for the body to cool down. When heat and humidity are extremely high, the human body can lose the ability to regulate its temperature. The body's temperature rises, and if this condition goes on long enough, death occurs. The tipping point means a combination of 35 degrees Celsius with enough humidity to make it difficult for humans to survive more than 6 hours. The researchers predict that in cities like Doha, Qatar, Abu Dhabi, and Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, and Bandar Abbas, Iran, could exceed the 35 degree Celsius threshold several times over a 30-year period. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In any war, the enemy's capital city is an important target. To capture the enemy's capital usually means victory. In the American Civil War, the North hoped for a quick victory by capturing the southern capital at Richmond, Virginia. Northern forces were strong enough. There were about 150,000 Union soldiers in and around Washington. General George McClellan led this Army of the Potomac. It was the biggest, best trained, and best equipped of the Union armies. This week in our series, Larry West and Tony Riggs report on McClellan's move against Richmond.
For the first year of the Civil War, the Army of the Potomac did not fight. General McClellan kept making excuses for his failure to act. He had a plan, he said, and he would not move until he was sure his men were ready. McClellan's plan was to put his army on boats in the Potomac River. They would sail down the river to where it emptied into the Chesapeake Bay. Then he would land the boats on the coast of Virginia, east of Richmond. President Abraham Lincoln wanted to capture the Confederate capital, but he did not like the idea of moving all of McClellan's men. That would leave the city of Washington without protection. McClellan tried to calm Lincoln's fears. He said that as soon as he marched toward Richmond, any Confederate soldiers near Washington would withdraw. They would be needed to defend their own capital.
The Army of the Potomac began to move on March 17th, 1862. Within 2 weeks, more than 50,000 had reached Fort Monroe, southeast of Richmond. They were equipped with 100 big guns and tons of supplies. Day by day, the Union force at Fort Monroe grew larger. McClellan had planned to move quickly to Yorktown, then push on to Richmond. He would move along the finger of land between the York River and the James River. He soon learned, however, that he could not move as quickly as planned. Heavy spring rains had turned the dirt roads into rivers of mud. McClellan's men could push through, but there was no way they could bring their big guns. McClellan decided to wait. He did not want to attack Yorktown without artillery.
President Lincoln was not pleased. He sent a message to McClellan. "You must strike a blow," Lincoln said. "You must act." But still, McClellan delayed. By the time his artillery had arrived and was in place, Confederate troops had withdrawn. They moved to the woods outside Williamsburg. McClellan chased them. For the first time, his army went into battle. The fighting was strange. The woods were so thick that the two sides could not often see each other. Soldiers fired at the flash of gunpowder, at noises, anything that moved. Their aim was good enough. About 4,000 soldiers were killed.
In his reports to Washington, McClellan claimed great victories at Yorktown and Williamsburg. Yet, he was worried. He believed the Confederate force around Richmond was much larger than his. He demanded more men. The Confederate force was, in fact, much smaller than the Union force, but it was deployed in a way to make it seem much larger. The trick fooled McClellan. By the middle of May, 1862, his army was only 15 kilometers from Richmond. Still, he did not attack. He continued to wait for more men and equipment. Confederate President Jefferson Davis was worried. He knew the Confederate Army was smaller than the Union Army. Davis's military advisor, General Robert E. Lee, offered a plan. Lee proposed that General Stonewall Jackson lead his army up Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. The North would see the move as a threat to Washington. Union troops would be kept near Washington instead of being sent to Richmond. President Davis agreed. Orders were sent to Jackson.
Stonewall Jackson was one of the South's best generals. He was a forceful leader, and he could make his men march until they dropped. He got the name Stonewall at the Battle of Bull Run in the summer of 1861. Southern soldiers were withdrawing. A Confederate officer tried to stop them. He urged them to follow Jackson's example, to stand and fight. He shouted, "There stands Jackson, like a stone wall." General Jackson faced three large Union forces in and around the Shenandoah Valley. Yet he struck hard and fast, and soon had control of the valley's main towns. His campaign is still studied at military schools around the world. It is considered an excellent example of how to move troops quickly to where they are most needed.
Jackson's raids produced the exact effect Robert E. Lee had wanted. Everyone in Washington feared an immediate attack on the city. Soldiers were hurried to the Capitol from Baltimore and other nearby cities. And President Lincoln sent thousands of troops to chase Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley instead of helping McClellan at Richmond. The Union Army outside Richmond was deployed on either side of the Chickahominy River. The Chickahominy was not a big river. It could be crossed easily at several places. While McClellan waited to attack the Confederate capital, heavy rains began to fall. The little river began to rise. The commander of Confederate forces in Richmond saw this as a chance to smash a large part of McClellan's army.
The flooding river would soon cut the Union force completely in two. When that happened, the Confederates would attack. They expected to destroy at least half of McClellan's army. The plan seemed good. And after the first few hours of battle, the Confederates were close to victory. But one bridge remained over the Chickahominy River. Union soldiers were able to cross it. The Confederates were forced to withdraw to their earlier positions. No ground was gained, and more than 11,000 men were killed or wounded. Among the wounded was the commander of all Confederate forces, General Joe Johnston. General Robert E. Lee would take his place.
Lee wasted no time. He wanted to push the Union Army far away from Richmond. First, however, he wanted more information about his enemy. He sent a young officer, Jeb Stuart, to get it. Stuart set off with more than 1,000 men on horseback. Theirs was a wild ride around the edge of the Union Army. When they reported back 3 days later, General Lee knew exactly where he would attack. It would be the first in a series of battles known as the 7 Days Campaign.
Lee took a big chance. He moved most of his men into position to attack what he now knew was the weak right side of the Union line. He left only a few thousand men to defend Richmond. He hoped the Union commander, McClellan, would be fooled by this plan. For if McClellan discovered how few men were left behind, he could smash through easily and capture the city. With the help of Stonewall Jackson's army, Lee's plan worked. McClellan was fooled. And after a day of fierce fighting, he was forced to withdraw from the area.
Lee chased McClellan for a while. They clashed at such places as Mechanicsville, White Oak Swamp, and finally Malvern Hill. The South won the 7 Days Campaign. The threat to Richmond was ended. The Confederacy was saved. But victory came at a terrible price. 20,000 Confederate soldiers were killed or wounded. As both the North and South were learning quickly, the Civil War was becoming more costly than anyone had imagined.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Larry West and Tony Riggs. Our series can be found online with transcripts, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our weekly programs on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.